Hey there, dudes and dudettes. Time to wax up your boards and go catch the big wave over at the LPN Beach Blanket Bingo. One night only at the Balboa Theater in San Diego, October 20th. Come and check out all of the cool cats and the crazy dogs at LPN. Every show in the entire network, each one pulsating and grinding in front of you for your entertainment pleasure. We're all gonna catch the big kahuna. And I'm talking about that big greasy guy. I'm talking about a wave.
Ew, it's seaweed. It's seaweed.
Just so you know, it's gonna be inside of a theater. So any physical wetness you experience is your own personal body heat or the sweat of one of the performers. Come and check it out. I'm certain if there's a podcast flavor you need on your tongue, we got the spoon for it. Beach Blanket Bingo, baby. Come on, girls, let's dance.
Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here, hanging out with Henry Zebrowski.
Oh, yeah.
Today's guest, we are honored to have him. He is a 74-time winner in a row. It's called a streak, folks, on Jeopardy. He is also the author of a new book, 100 Places to See After You Die. Ken Jennings is with us. Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Dude.
Yes, indeed.
Can't believe you're here. You're too smart to be here. This is great. Honestly, you'll see immediately. You'll immediately be like, why did I do this?
Yeah.
Why did I take time out of it? Because you're in the middle of a tournament right now, right?
Yeah, the Jeopardy Masters tournament is over. But Jeopardy continues through July, and I'm on a book tour now. Many people warned me not to do this show. Ken, you're too smart for this, they said. But yep. I am a big fan, and I'm delighted to be here.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much. So my first question is, because the rise of the machines, I'm not really a fan of these robots.
Keith immediately, I'm sorry, I gotta talk to you
about this goddamn schmuck, IBM Watson. So he beat you, and he cheated, of course, because he's got all the numbers, he's got all the Google. What do you want to do to IBM Watson? Should we take it out in the field, office space it, baseball bats, golf clubs, destroy this absolute disgusting devil box? What are your thoughts on Watson? Just let me know. Cut a promo.
I felt very obsolete back in 2011 when I lost to Watson. I felt like this was the beginning of the information, of the machines coming for these information economy jobs, knowing stuff, learning stuff, writing stuff. It was all about to go. And then for a decade, it didn't happen. And I thought, oh, it's just me. I'm the only one who was put out of work. Jeopardy champions are out of work. But now in the ChatGPT era, it looks like the machines are back. Watson was the first Terminator where it's just one guy. But now there's an army of Terminators coming for us.
Yeah, new liquid lady Terminators. It's going to get very, very intense.
Yeah, that was the one thing. They could have given Watson like a mustache or something, as opposed to you just like looking like you're losing to a shitty Tesla. It must have been infuriating, all of the work that you put in. And then all of a sudden, this goddamn glorified Rubik's Cube comes out of nowhere and everyone's talking about it like it has feelings. It didn't know it won.
It didn't care. It was a big black rectangle on TV. Do you know why? It was a flat screen TV turned on its side. That's all Watson's face was. And then it had a mechanical thumb. And that was really its advantage. It could buzz faster than any human. So the robots don't know more than we do yet, but they are much better at pressing a Jeopardy button.
Okay, makes me feel better.
Would you say that was like the key? Because how do you prepare for that? Like, because I kind of want to know, is that an extension for how you prepared to be a Jeopardy contestant? Like, did you prep to be like,
thumb training?
How does that translate to then fighting the same? Like, you go against meat people, which is one thing, but then you have to go against a flat screen. Like, how does it change your preparation?
Yeah, I do a lot of thumb yoga.
Good.
You know, watching the show is the best prep because you really do want to get into the rhythm of, okay, here's how fast the host reads the clues and here's when I buzz. Because the buzzer's set up such that if you buzz early, you actually lock yourself out for a minute. Oh. So when you see people on Jeopardy flailing away, those are not people who buzz too late. They buzzed too early and locked themselves out. So a lot of the prep is just watching the show and getting into that rhythm. And of course, you know, we're in the Moneyball era of Jeopardy where players will, you know, just build simulators at home and spend hours drilling themselves on vice presidents and state birds and all the rest. There is a lot of Jeopardy training that happens now. It's like a Rocky montage in a bunch of nerds' basements.
I love that.
But when you're facing a computer, was at that point, I know it was like kind of like, it was a fun thing. It was kind of like an exercise on Jeopardy. But when you were like, do you feel like genuine resentment or like that you go against this machine? Like, would you know, like, is it like, what's it like, you're a jobber in the WWE where you have to go lose to The Rock? Or were you like, no, I'm going to go beat this machine?
I thought we had a chance. I thought we had a real chance. And there were warm-up games where Brad and I, the two human players, we actually beat the robot. But in the actual game, it got a good spread of categories. The things that humans would have been good at, kind of high concept problem solving, and very short clues where the computer takes a minute to chug along. And if the clue is short, maybe the human can get in there first. Mm. There just weren't enough of those. And so it was lights out for the human race. I'm sorry I let everybody down.
It just was the first one. Just the first true loss. That's fine.
You didn't let us down, Ken. The fix was in. We all saw what happened in clear, plain sight. Obviously, Trebek had it out for you. So when it comes to you now host, so you're the star, 74 straight wins. What a ride. You made Jeopardy cool. Jeopardy's been around for a long time. It always has ebbs and flows.
I will it's do some pushback cool, on just but, that. Alex Trebek did make it cool, but no, you it was, continued yes. the, but, you're continuing
but,
it.
But the run that Ken had, I mean, you remember 04? All of a sudden, everyone's like, yo, Jeopardy, this guy's on a run. People started watching 30 wins in, 40 wins in. You get all the way up to 74 wins. That must have been an absolute shock. I don't know you personally, but a lot of times people who are intellectual can also be introvert. And then all of a sudden, you are literally on the cover of magazines as the world's smartest man. How do you make a mistake after that? Can you like fuck up your Starbucks order without everyone being like, I guess it's all a show. Turns out it's a fraud.
Every single time I walk up to a door and I pull instead of push,
yes.
I look around. Like, is anybody observing? Is anybody seeing what it's just a
lot,
happened?
It's here? A lot of pressure to be the smartest man in America.
People often do come up to me with trivia questions they want to stump me with. And what I discovered is the play there is to try to get it wrong because it's easier for me. It's more satisfying for them. Really, everybody wins. So I'm fine being a punching bag for all these young gunslingers.
Yeah, that's what you got to do because they're all training up on you. But now you're in charge. Like, do you feel that now that you're like hosting Jeopardy? Like does that like what kind of pressure is that like on yourself? Like, do you feel like you could go back and win now? Like, do the same.
No, I'm way too old. Like, I was still in my 20s when I was first on the show, which meant I had the young, plastic, sexy brain of a 29-year-old. And now I forget things and I remember names slower. And it's all starting to go, you guys.
Is that right? So that's interesting. It's actually like an athletic venture. There's a certain time. There's a certain peak time frame for a Jeopardy contestant.
I mean, we all start to forget things, but maybe I just notice it sooner. The way, like you say, the way a running back notices his knees and his hips aren't what they were before a normal person like you or I would, you know, cause that's their meal ticket. And so I'm the same way. Like the last time I played Jeopardy on the GOAT tournament, I got lucky and I beat James Holzhauer, but I was I'm like Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon. You know, I'm getting way too old for this. I'm very happy to be hosting and retired now.
That's awesome. And then with your insight in playing, have you ever seen a contestant and you're just like, buddy, how did you get on the show? You are like, is there, because it's.
Yeah, you, who did you have sex with that wasn't me that got you this far?
Because literally, it would be like Michael Jordan doing commentary, just eviscerating everyone who isn't as great as he is. Is that that must be an interesting experience to see the newbies coming in there and sweating it out?
I mean, I have so much sympathy for them because, you know, what they're putting themselves through. Playing Jeopardy is a very intense experience. And, you know, having seen it on your couch for years is not really any kind of preparation. It's very intense and surreal to suddenly be there. And I remember that kind of panic. And I do everything I can to settle them down. And, you know, sometimes they have a good game and sometimes they don't. But, you know, I know what they're going through. It's a lot harder than it seems on your couch, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah, especially because the camera's right on you. And then the effect I think that a lot of people have who've not been on camera a lot then you see yourself on camera afterwards. Oof. I feel like there's like a doubling up effect. If you make it to the second night and you watch yourself perform on television the night before, yeah. you know that you're just like, oh, wow, I have a tell. I'm greasy. What's wrong with you just like thinking about this?
There's a zit growing as you're staring at yourself. That's a great point. Did you watch your performances with a nice champagne and a cigar, or were you just scared shitless?
I mean, luckily in most cases, your shows are all going to be taped months before they air. You know, we do five in a day and then they air 2 or 3 months later. Okay. So in most cases, by the time somebody is able to watch their shows, they know, okay, I lost 2 nights after this. This happened back in June. In my case, I was on long enough that, yeah, my show started to air on TV and I'm still playing. So contestants would show up to Jeopardy and be like, oh, no, it's this guy still. Well, how can it still be this guy? Nobody was happy to see me.
No, that's the best part, because they're like, oh, no, there's a fucking killer in here already. Like,
I love it.
It's a lot. I'd love to talk to you about you have your podcast, Omnibus.
Yes.
You're also working. I do want to bring up, like, because we are our purveyors of dark history and we're really into dark history. What do you feel like as a take? Because, like, you kind of going through like dark, obscure history. For you, what's like a takeaway that you have about learning about history that you would apply to kind of like now?
I wonder if. I feel like the mistake we always make thinking about now is that we're different. You know, there's something special and unique about our generation and our time that is nothing like anybody else ever went through. That we're in modernity, we are special little snowflakes. And I think that's the illusion. I think the more you read about the weird little back alleys of history, you find out, oh no, people were worried about something like exactly like my neurosis 500 years ago or 2000 years ago, you know, that the human experience is pretty universal. And maybe that's reassuring because we got this far. You know, there were a ton of existential threats and we're the ones who made it. And maybe that'll happen again. Maybe our kids are going to be okay because they'll figure it out as well.
I realized that when we covered the Black Plague, we talked about at the time, it's like everywhere you go, you realize like the modern brain has been like this. Like we've been modern people for a really long time in human history. And so a lot of times it's what they're concerned about, like how in the Black Plague, they were still talking about like one of the worst fates that can happen to you is the bards get a hold of your story and they make fun of you for generations. And that was considered a curse, which is like, it's still kind of real. Like it's still like the power of what SNL does, what certain things do. We're just making fun of somebody can sometimes destroy everything you know about them.
I mean, to this day on Jeopardy, people will be like, I just don't want to go viral. Like that'll be their one dream. I don't care if I win or not. Please do not let me go viral. And that makes sense.
Well, what causes something to go viral? Is it always a mistake? Can't something positive go viral? Not just someone who randomly queefed. Why? It's always like negativity feeds the internet. Yes, go on.
Sometimes on Jeopardy, something good or funny will happen, and that's what people like. You know, we kind of have a gentle property, and so often it is something surprisingly good. Often it'll be somebody doing something dumb, don't get me wrong. But if, you know, on Jeopardy, you don't expect something funny or dramatic to happen. So good stuff goes viral too, which is nice.
Yeah, that is nice.
Live from your grave.
Mr. Jennings, you're not going to make Jeopardy more extreme, right? You're going to do things where you're going to have like pranks. And like things to like shooting out at people,
dude,
and like, you know, the platforms falling out. Like you're just
double
gonna keep
dare,
it.
Double Dare meets Jeopardy. We need slime.
Yeah, we're gonna go back to Fear Factor. If you find the Daily God, Double, you're gonna have to eat like donkey rectums, and sadly, Joe Rogan's gonna be there. It's not gonna be a good scene.
Yeah, that is. Remember that? Everyone was just eating cow balls at like 8 p.m. on Saturday, and people are like, "This is good old fashioned Christian values."
He's almost a billionaire.
That's crazy. He doesn't need Jeopardy.
No,
he doesn't need Jeopardy.
No,
you should
doesn't.
Bring in. Maybe there's also a possibility to bring in America's dumbest people.
That's what I'm saying. Well, they already do Celebrity Jeopardy, dumbest celebrity you've ever met.
Hey,
that's fine.
It's better now. It's better now than the Will Ferrell years.
Yeah, no, it's Celebrity Jeopardy is tough because you're trying to find famous people who are willing to do a show with no upside at all. Like, if they do fine, nobody's going to be like, hey, Patton Oswalt's pretty smart. But if they get one thing wrong, it's like, lol, this guy got Golden Girls confused with Dream Girls. Like, what a dope.
Guess you're an idiot.
Yeah, for the rest of your life. Yeah, it's horrible.
So, yes, let's talk about 100 places to see after you die. What was the motivation for writing this book? And as Henry alluded to,
this is a great concept. I love this concept.
Yes, yeah, so fun. It seems like it's an extension, obviously, of your intelligence and understanding of history. What was it that you wanted to share with us, the readers, 100 places to see after you die?
I liked the idea of a travel guide to the afterlife because I've always been super interested. Even as a kid, I loved mythology. And growing up when I did as a Gen Xer, you guys probably remember this time when it seemed like the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs and who built the pyramids were just going to be the most important things in our life. Do you remember that?
It's how we got to this point with last podcast. There was a seed planted into us elder millennials.
It was all Time Life books making us think about these mysteries. And to me, the afterlife was always one of these great mysteries. Like, it's just maddening that billions of people have died and they either know or don't what awaits us. And we're here like chumps just wondering and worrying for 80 years. And so I love this idea, you know, ghosts, heaven, hell. I love the whole thing. Yeah. And this book is just kind of about the story of humankind trying to get its mind around what might await us in the undiscovered country, whether it's you know, all the way from ancient Egypt to Dante's Inferno up to, you know, TV shows like The Good Place. We're still worried about it today.
Does that stem for you from an understanding of so much? Again, obviously high intelligence. You understand humanity. You have the ability to speak and be charming. Usually these things don't go hand in hand. Is it because this is actually something that is difficult to grasp? This actually still expands the brain, this idea of, you know, the second life.
Well, it's a combination of two things. One, it's the thing we're probably most worried about. The most universal concern is death, life and death, right? It faces us all. And then the second thing is, it's a mystery. Like, what is it? Like, surely this can't be everything, right? There are, you know, if you look at poll numbers over the years, the number of Americans who are religiously observant goes down every year. Fewer people going to church or synagogue or mosque, fewer people reading their holy books, fewer people praying. But the number of people who believe in the afterlife goes up every year. We're so resistant to this idea that I won't see my loved ones again, that the thing that makes me might just end. I mean, maybe that's the real answer, but it doesn't seem like the most beautiful answer, right?
I wonder if in America, a lot, especially recently, it feels that a lot of people kind of hope, well, maybe it'll be better then. You know what I mean? I'm going to go through all of this horseshit now, but there's going to be, don't worry, there's going to be some place. All of this will be taken care of one day.
It's so funny to look at century or millennia of human conceptions of heaven, because it starts, we have records from like ancient Babylon where they can't really imagine a better life. Like, they write about heaven and it's like, the crop blight will be slightly less, you know, or the rainy season will have less sleet and more pleasant drizzle. You know, they have very achievable goals in heaven. And it's only later, as you know, we move from hunter-gatherers to a more prosperous people, that people start to imagine, hey, what if there's amazing banquets? What if we all get gold and jewels? What if there's harems of attractive young mates? You know, that's when the imaginations start to ramp up.
It's so interesting.
It is wish fulfillment, yeah.
Why is that? Why do you think the connection to, like, because I know everything changed once we stopped being like nomadic, but what was that jump? Like, why go from, is it because it's the only time we can really imagine the concept of having more than you need?
Yeah, I guess until there's cities and kings and an actual noble class where you can be like, wow, he's got kind of a nice palace. Oh, he wears a fancy hat made of a metal I've never seen. Like, until that point, you can't even imagine what a beautiful heaven would be. That's why all the old underworlds are just kind of like dark, shadowy places, kind of like now, but a little less vivid. You know, it takes a while for the human race to develop the idea of reward and punishment.
Does that disprove or prove the idea of an afterlife more? The fact that it just sort of changes as people change? I guess that it would, right? Because it's all an illusion anyway, even if it's real.
Yeah, it definitely shows that we know nothing, that it's a mystery. And as we move away from religious fundamentalism, you know, obviously all the good recent afterlives are pitched by TV showrunners instead of cult leaders. You know, it's a different kind of cult. So it's, you know, the afterlives on movies and TV shows are very inventive now and delightful. You know, I remember watching The Leftovers, and on that show, the afterlife was kind of like a video game. And yeah. I thought, you know, this never would have occurred to Dante or Virgil. You know, like we have all these cool options today of what we imagine the other world could be. But of course, as you say, we're just making it up. We're whistling in the dark.
Well, I can see us heading towards a Wall-E style world where if we can make our meat live to 150, 175, but people don't got that money to live that life anymore, I can end up seeing extended living afterlives where we are put in stasis, where essentially we are like they do in anesthesia, whatever, they bring you down to zero and then you're in a helmet for forever. Like, maybe that's kind of what the Bardo will eventually be.
Yeah, Philip K. Dick thought so. He thought the Tibetan Bardo was going to be reached in cold freeze chambers. But the ones that could actually happen, I think, are like, what if our brain becomes uploadable? You know, you're making fun of Watson and ChatGPT, but like there could be a human afterlife in a server somewhere, you know, if at the moment of our death, we can.
The poetic justice.
Like, we can actually choose our heaven.
Man, you downloading your brain into a computer, coming back to kick the shit out of kids in Jeopardy in 2100.
The Ken Jennings 1000. I love
that
it.
That would be the dream, yeah.
We're going to give you a huge wad, buddy. We're not going to let that just be a normal screen. We're going to show the people how smart you are from below the waist down.
Huge dick.
Before, I want to be like a hologram. I want to be like hologram Tupac playing Jeopardy.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when I think of Ken Jennings, I often think of Tupac. And so when it comes to, we've discussed heaven. What about this idea of fucking eternal doom? What is that? Yeah. What, like, when you were doing research on that, because obviously Henry and I and Marcus are tri-host, you know, we love the dark and the macabre and stuff. Yeah. And it's fascinating, you know, playing in the world of, you know, even Adam Sandler's Little Nicky. It's like fun. What is like the darkest possible afterlife that you've explored that people have sort of fantasized about?
I feel like all these hells, it probably came about as a means of control, right? You know, if you're a religious thinker or leader, you really want to impress people with how awful the punishments are going to be and how terrible, like, and this is what all these descriptions of hell are. You're going to be have molten metal poured on you for this many trillion years, and then you're going to have to drink your own pus and snot for another trillion years. And it's very culturally universal, like whether you're Chinese or Inuit or Babylonian, whatever, like the punishments are all the same. And it's funny because by the time you get to Dante, like, and Hieronymus Bosch, these paintings and poems, clearly they're more interested in hell than in heaven. You know, to them, that's the vivid, exciting stuff. And all their fans want to read, it's like a fantasy novel for the Italian Renaissance. You know, Dante's Inferno came out with maps and illustrations and in a time before Game of Thrones, you would imagine yourself, you know, exploring this crazy 9-level fantasy world. Like, even though we're supposed to be scared of hell, we just can't help but be fascinated with it.
Yeah.
In that dissection of hell, like, do you think that they were meant to be taken literally, or is it allegorical? Like, was it supposed to be that? Like, you're supposed to, was that map created so that you think that, oh, you actually do go to these places? Or, like, of the time period, how do people respond to that work? Were they like, or is it just entertaining?
I think a lot of them were still fundamentalist, and they were like, yeah, I guess if I'm bad, I'm going to be here in the seventh circle with the gluttons or whatever.
It's one of those things I always wonder. We joke on we talk about in the show about ancient history, and we always wonder, like, what do they actually believe and what were stories? Like, what were things that in what societies thought was like legit, and what do they think was like, oh, well, this is just supposed to describe things in a general sense.
As you were saying, Ken, for control, for political reasons, and then did they actually have those thoughts?
I know what I was going to say. Like, if you look at the actual biblical text, it's all very vague on heaven and hell. You know, there is a lake of fire, but it does seem like it might be a vision or an allegory. It's only later where you have these very literal pastors who are really trying to put the fear of God into kids, where they say, oh, yeah, you don't want those coals burning you for thousands of years, right? So you better straighten up. And that's, you know, it's not limited to Christianity. Lots of traditions have those very visceral threats.
Live from your grave.
So what would you say your perfect afterlife would be? Because everyone's heaven or hell would be different. I think some people's heaven would probably just be left alone playing with guard. I would go crazy and be like, no one's laughing at my jokes. I'm feel very, But then, you know, so I want like a crowd of people and we're having a great time or we're getting hammered. Someone might be absolutely weeping in the corner at that idea of heaven. What is your idea? What would be your Ken Jennings uploaded into a computer? So you're still with us, destroying the robots from within, but your spectral realm, your spirit world, where is it?
You know, there's 100 different afterlives in the book. And honestly, the one that has always appealed to me the most is the one in Field of Dreams, just kind of a soothing afternoon of old-timey baseball in a cornfield. That seems like a very good vibe. But if I could pick anything, like including an afterlife of my own invention, I think what I would want, and this is, I guess, pretty on brand for Jeopardy, is I would want answers. Like I would want the version of the afterlife where you can say, hey, you know, God, what really happened to the dinosaurs? Was it a comet or what? And what happened to, like, who was Jack the Ripper? What was the deal with that? Like, how did the pyramids get built? You finally get the answers to all your questions. Like, God is a librarian. I think I would enjoy that.
I do love that idea. But then isn't that, but then would that become boring?
No more mystery.
No more mystery. But I suppose there's always mystery.
But what is satisfaction then, Ken? What is satisfaction? What happens after?
Right. This is the hard part of describing heaven is there's no narrative arc. They can just say, well, it's so good, you can't imagine it. And it's that forever. And I think there are a lot of modern afterlives where they're like, well, forever. That seems kind of scary, actually. There are whole TV shows and talking head songs about how if heaven did last forever, that might actually be kind of mind-blowingly terrible.
I did a show called Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, and the pilot of it featured heaven was like a place where it was nothing but like babes and pizza trees, right? So people eating the pizza trees. It was written by David Willis, who did Aqua Teen Hunger Force, and he literally was like, they were like, I'm sick of pizza. Like, that was like the central joke, is that at the end of it, you're like, well, you have as much pizza as you want. And you're like, I'm sick of pizza.
I think that was the great innovation of the TV show The Good Place. Like, hell is not hot irons being placed on your skin. It's just the endless banality of this life. Too many Pirates of the Caribbean movies, too many frozen yogurt places, too much Axe body spray. You know, that it's not just that hell is torture, hell is other people. It's like hell is the little annoyances of this life.
Well, Ken, that brings me to a great question. Why Axe body spray so cold? I put it on because I have my little brother, and he's an Axe body spray guy, special needs kind of. And so I was wearing it, and it's fucking cold when it comes out of there. Why?
Well, you know, I think you may misunderstand what a Jeopardy host does. I don't explain how body sprays work to random people. That's not part of the job description.
I would assume to explain to him, Mr. Jennings, that you're just not an info booth. Like,
he
we can't just come to you. No, we can't just come and just ask him random things that we've been wondering about.
Why is Axe body spray so cold? There's no answer?
Okay. I think it has some highly volatile stuff in it, like alcohols, you know, something that evaporates quickly. So when you put something on you that evaporates quickly, temperature is lowered by the chemical process. Like, heat is used up. And
yeah, that's
feel
pretty
cold.
Exciting answer, Ken.
Hey, I'm sorry. It's not like I'm the one who asked it. I don't want to throw blame here, but.
Anyway, so honestly, can we talk about Alex Trebek for a second?
Yes.
Is he exactly as he appeared?
He very much was. I mean, he was more fun. Like, and that's hard to imagine someone less fun than he appeared on Jeopardy. But during commercials, he would tell jokes, go into the crowd. He loved to warm up the crowd himself and do little impressions. And, you know, he was a very light, funny guy. But, you know, he had to keep the show moving because that's the job description. The things you think you know about him, that he's smart, that he actually knew all those answers and wanted you to know that he knew them and, you know, was very well-read and kind of a gentleman of the old school. All 100% true.
That's
what
great.
Did you discover when you got behind the podium that you were like, oh, shit, this is actually completely a different. I did not know. Like, was there something that you were like, did you get newfound respect for Mr. Trebek when you're the captain of the ship?
Yeah.
He made it look so easy for 30 odd years that I think we thought it was easy to host Jeopardy. We'll just put in guest hosts. You know, Aaron Rodgers can probably do this. And what I found out was that it's extremely hard. The game moves so fast. The host is, you know, juggling three or four things at once, trying to, you know, be a referee and a play-by-play guy and a stadium announcer, and a narrator. You know, you're doing all these things at once. Final Jeopardy is particularly hard because there's so much math involved. You have a little card full of numbers of permutations of what if he gets it wrong, but she gets it right, and so forth. and you're trying to create drama out of basically what looks like a Sudoku.
Yeah.
And it's still the hardest moment of the show for me.
Did he give you any advice? Obviously, I think that he knew that, you know, you were going to be potentially filling the unbelievable void that he left. Did he give you any, you know, insight into hosting or anything like that?
Yeah, I actually ended up talking to him what turned out to be the night before the day he passed away. About guest hosting for him. And we didn't know. We thought, oh, he's going to get better. He's going to bounce back. He'll be hosting again. I was just going to fill in. And we talked about the game, and, you know, he gave me the impression he always did over the years, which was that he did not want to be the center of attention on Jeopardy. You know, he was never announced as the star of Jeopardy. He was always the host of Jeopardy, because he thought the game itself and the contestants should be the star. And it's just such a, can you imagine anybody else in Hollywood saying, hey, I'm on one of the biggest shows on TV, but it shouldn't be all about me. You know, it's just that kind of Canadian working class grit would be so foreign to show business. But
and it's the respect of the game itself, right? I mean, that's what's so cool about Jeopardy. And he led the way. He was the head coach, you know, but that respect for the game.
He was absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way to host it. Like I do the same thing. Like, this should not be about me. This should be about these three people and the clues. And that's what people want.
You're genuinely good at it, man. I'm going to say this. I never get to do stuff like say directly to people like, I love Jeopardy and you're doing great. It's really, really great.
I appreciate that. It's a very hard gig, but I'm slowly figuring it out.
Yeah. Have you been overwhelmed when you've been in the world now for 19 some years by the fandom and the support that Jeopardy enthusiasts have? Because, you know, we do a lot of the Comic Cons. We were just at WonderCon, and it's really fascinating. I love people that love stuff. What's the fandom like for Jeopardy?
The funny thing is, Jeopardy was a very early parasocial relationship for people before we even had podcasts or knew what that word meant. Like, because people watch Jeopardy every night, they kind of felt like Alex was in their home. You know, it's really part of the ritual of people's day in a way that no other show is anymore. You know, like, Carson's gone, Cronkite's gone, but people still remember watching Jeopardy with grandma, or, you know, watching it with their friends in the dorms, or, you know, it's kind of a ritual for people. And it really is nice because they see you and they feel like they know you, you know, and everybody's, the most common thing I hear is, can my 90-year-old grandma just loves you? can you call my grandma? Can you take a picture from my grandma? I feel like I have taken pictures for all of America's grandmas at this point. I'm doing my part.
Yep. And that's the next big scandal.
If you know what I mean.
Grandma lover, Ken Jennings. Honestly,
Ken Jennings.
But someone's got to. Someone really has
someone's
to.
Someone's got to.
This has been such a privilege for
us. It has.
To take your time, sir. I am glad. This is your like all of your current, like, outside of Jeopardy, like, focuses are way in our alley of interest. It's great. It's all, like, very interesting. Omnibus is a really good sleeper podcast, and you'll feel like what information you get in there is, like, really very interesting. I love the Tartarian Empire. I love that whole concept. It's really, really cool. Like, all it's, they keep at it, man. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. I'm having a great time. Jeopardy's a great side gig while I do the podcast and the books and whatnot. I feel very lucky it came into my life. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you are just, I mean, honestly, it's been so great to talk with you. You're so funny and wonderful. And again, congratulations on all your success. That's almost impossible. People don't really understand how difficult it is to go from contestant to host, because there's a lot of people that want that job that are behind the scenes clamoring for it. And for you to be able to navigate the political sphere of all of that as well, I'm sure that's a whole nother conversation we'll have to have over beers, because I can just imagine.
Yeah, I was for years, I was convinced I would never even get an audition because you would want a broadcaster to do that job. So I just have to pinch myself at how lucky I am that it was always my favorite show as a kid. And now I get to do it all the time. It's a real privilege.
That's awesome.
What you got to do now is go, you and Aaron Rodgers need to have some kind of other kind of competition with each other when you do the combine.
Let me put it this way. He is a much better Jeopardy host than I would be Jets quarterback, and it's not even close.
Well, was he an asshole? I'm a Packers fan, but was Aaron an asshole?
I wasn't there when he was hosting, but I thought he was one of my wife said that he was her favorite guest host. And when I drilled down a little, what it turns out is that means he's very handsome. I think that's what she was getting at there.
Oh,
Something about it. Sure. Something about him. Ken Jennings, everybody. Thank you so much for being on the show, Ken. And everyone, check out the book, 100 Places to See After You Die. Listen to the podcast, Omnibus. And, of course, watch Ken host Jeopardy. Thank you so much, Ken. You were wonderful.
Dude.
That was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you
so much, man.
Live from your grave.
All right, there was our conversation with Ken Jennings. We made him dumber.
We're going to hang out with him.
We are going to hang out with him. I can't wait. Because
we're going to hang out with him. We're going to get it. You know how we get him? That's what we're saying. He loves grandmas. We get them all out there. We all hang out. We have a nice brunch.
Mm.
We go out there. We have a couple of mimosas.
Sure.
We go to an afternoon disco. We're all asleep by 8.
Yep. Grandma's mating call. Also, Henry, rubber band. You work with, get some tension for the thumb.
Oh.
Because I think out of all of us, don't tell Marcus, but I actually think you might have what it takes. Marcus is going to crack. I think he would crack under the... I think his thumb would break. And then I could maybe get one question right. But I think
I'm pretty good.
Chance.
I can be good. I have a lot of arcane,
trivial
bits of information in my mind. But I think Jeopardy has gotten harder since I was a kid.
Well, you also
I think
do
a harder
good job.
Game now.
You hold on to song lyrics. You have a good retention in the mind. I would be your number one fan out there. I'd be there for you, buddy.
I'd finally... They'll be like, finally, look at the... Oh, man.
Celebrity Jeopardy.
A Polish Jeopardy champion.
I think, honestly, if it's Celebrity Jeopardy, you, Brendan Schaub.
Yep. I could be Brendan Schaub.
Yeah.
I could be Brendan Schaub. I could be...
a whole series of other people.
And me, comedian brand. Honestly, would be pretty sweet.
You got it. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Check out, again, Ken Jennings' book, 100 Places to See After You Die.
I can't wait. Honestly, I can't. Honestly, when I found out that he had a dark history podcast, I was all about it. It's pretty fucking great.
I want to go to the afterlife right now. Okay, everyone, hail yourselves.
No, he doesn't want to die. Thank you for your money.
I want to go to the afterlife. I want to live forever.
Yeah, I want to go to that. Yeah, I'd love to go to the afterlife as long as I can come back.
Can you imagine if we did know, like, the mass suicide that would happen if people did know there was an afterlife?
Oh, yeah, sure. But that's what I've always saying. It's like, if the Pope thinks heaven's so great, why is he still alive?
Right. Oh, he's dying, by the way. Did you see?
Oh, I know. He's sick. Yeah.
We'll talk about him.
Another one down.
All right. Hail yourselves. Bye.
Bye.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.